My name's Andrew Tolley, and this is going to be the course on the explorations in cosmology. And it's actually going to be split. I'm going to more or less teach the first half, and Sarah Shandara is going to teach the second half of the course. What the topic of this is mainly going to be about is inflationary cosmology. But what we're really going to do is get into the nitty-gritty of the aspects of quantum field theory in a curved space-time, and as they are used in the context of early universe cosmology, and in particularly inflationary theory, which is the dominant current dominant theory that describes the early universe and the origin of primordial density fluctuations that subsequently seed the growth of galaxies. And so at some level, this course is really going to be about quantum field theory in curved spacetimes. And so what I'll do is actually start by reviewing what we mean by quantum field theory in curved spacetimes and distinguishing how quantum field theory in curved spacetimes differs from the normal quantum field theory in Minkowski space that you learn in standard courses. And in particular, it's not really just going to be any old curved spacetimes, but the key point is they're going to be time-dependent spacetimes. And that's really where all the interesting stuff happens and makes the predictions non-trivial. Then I'm going to recap the story of inflation, the basic inflationary story. And then what we'll do is we'll start putting these two things together. In particular, we'll think about how to couple quantum fields and gravity together. More precisely, that's how do we quantize gravity as a low energy effective field theory. And part of that is going to be also knowing how the scalar fields that are what drive inflation, how they couple to gravity. What we'll want to do is develop things in the context of a gauge invariant formalism. That'll describe the mixing of the fields with gravity. And then we'll really get to the nitty-gritty stuff, which mostly Sarah will do, but we'll be calculating correlation functions of quantum fields, specifically the inflaton field, the gauge invariant combinations that give rise to it, and looking at the predictions that give rise to, how that maps with the primordial power spectrum. And then non-Gaussianities. Everyone see down there? It's a little bit low. Yep.
It's probably not a good idea
to go too low. Okay. All right, so that's more or less the plan. And basically, in real terms, it's going to bring you up to a state of, you know, current research in inflationary cosmology, and particularly the topic of calculating quantum fluctuations of the inflaton, looking at their predictions, specifically looking at non-Gaussianities, is a topic of considerable current research in different models. But what we'll more or less for the first week spend most of our time doing is really thinking about quantum field theory in curved spacetimes and how they differ from the standard story. So when you learn basic quantum mechanics, you learn that there's something called wave-particle duality, which is a fuzzy notion, which says that in some sense, every particle we know about, whilst it has a particle description, also in some limit it has a wave description. And we understand that in quantum mechanics, is that really the particle should be described by a wave function, which gives the probability amplitude to be for the particle to be found at some point. But we can nevertheless still detect a particle as a discrete quantized object. But when we go to field theory, these two concepts really get combined into the single concept of a quantum field that I'm just going to denote as 5x from now on. And in fact, most of this initial discussion is really just going to be in the context of scalar quantum fields. Now, a quantum field is an object that, on the one hand, you can have states of that quantum field that also just correspond to classical fields. For example, electromagnetism, you have electric fields and magnetic fields, and you can have classical configurations of those electric and magnetic fields. But at the same time, it's also the quantity that encapsulates all the particle concepts inside it. So the electromagnetic potential also is the object that describes all the quantum states of photons, not just single photon states, but multiphoton states as well. And in general, we can think of a state of a quantum field. So something, for example, where the field takes some value phi of x, meaning that in some sense, let me describe the operator with a hat to distinguish it. So this state is an eigenstate of that operator with some specific eigenvalue phi of x. That's a state of a quantum field. That's a quantum mechanical state where you say the field at some time just has a particular configuration. And you can find such a state. But that state also has another physical interpretation as really a sum over multi-particle states. Where the particles are the basic quantized states of this field. So in particular, when you do this in Minkowski space, right. Yes. That's right.
So the classical field is the eigen.
This is the classical field. That's the operator. Exactly. Because just as in quantum mechanics, the way it's going to play out is that the fields, of course, commute with each other at different points in space, but the field and its associated momenta won't commute. So just as in quantum mechanics, the natural eigenstate, well, one particular nice choice of eigenstates is a state where the particle has a definite position. In quantum field theory, the equivalent of that is a configuration where the field has a definite field value at some fixed time. But of course, in such a state, it's a time derivative, so its momentum would be infinitely uncertain, just as in standard quantum mechanics. So these are the natural states of the field. But they're not normally the states that you use when you learn about quantum field theory. When you learn about quantum field theory, you learn about particle states. You learn how to construct a Fock space by building up multiparticle states. And the way that works, more or less, is that you take your field, your quantum field, and you expand it in Minkowski space into positive and negative energy modes with associated creation and annihilation operators. So this, of course, is your annihilation operator, and this is your creation operator. And this thing here is what colloquially we call the positive energy mode, where positive energy means that the energy comes in as e to the minus I e t over h bar, and then with E here is the angular frequency, I'm a Gaucher. And so if this was some massive scalar field, then we would have omega k squared is k squared plus m squared in units where c is h bar is equal to 1. Now, this is the standard story of what you do in quantum field theory in Minkowski spacetime. You split your field up into creation and annihilation operators. And the physical interpretation of what these guys do is, of course, that they create and annihilate particles. In particular, you assume the existence of a vacuum state, which is a state which is annihilated by all the annihilation operators for all different values of k. And then from that vacuum state, you then build up your multiparticle state by applying creation operators on top of it. So roughly speaking, AK dagger 0 gives me a state of a single particle with momenta k. And of course, these guys really here are vector quantities that we're describing. Similarly, if I apply two creation operators with different values for the k's, then what I end up doing is creating a state with two particles, one with momentum k1, one with momentum k2, and so on. And so in general, an n particle state is obtained by the application of n creation operators to the vacuum, with different indices representing the different individual momenta or whatever other quantum numbers the state is specified by. So in general, a quantum field, the configuration where the quantum field has a definite configuration, is a superposition of all these multiparticle states. So we can think of it as a sum over terms in which you have, for example, you've got the vacuum with some coefficient plus the single particle state, a dagger k, with some coefficient, plus then the two particle state with some coefficient, and so on. And this, of course, is saying what we're doing here is representing the quantum field in the so-called Fock space, which is the state where you construct the, you start out constructing the Hilbert space for a single particle, which is described by these things. And then the Fock space is constructed by summing tensor products of the Hilbert space together for the single particle to describe, for example, this is how you describe the wave function for the three particle state. And so what you're effectively doing is summing powers of products of the Hilbert space tensored together, describing your multiparticle wave function. And that's the standard construction of the Fock space in terms of the single particle Hilbert space. Now, hopefully most of that is more or less familiar, at least the construction of the Fock space and so on. So that's the standard story. Now, what makes quantum field theory in curved spacetimes different, and specifically what makes quantum field theory in time-dependent spacetimes different, is that in general, there isn't an unambiguous way to specify what you mean by a particle. There is no question about what you mean by a field. We're going to write down a field equation on the time-dependent spacetime, which will just look like a classical field equation, and then we'll stick a little hat on it to say that it's an operator, and we'll imply some commutation relations that phi x, phi y is 0, and phi x, phi y is 0. And we can do all that, and there's unambiguous what the left-hand side means. Where the problem, or it's not really a problem, of course, because we know how to deal with it, But where the ambiguity is and where you see the difference between everything you learn about in quantum field theory, Minkowski space-time, and in curved space-time, is over on the right-hand side, is that we'll see there isn't a definite way, there isn't an unambiguous or a unique way to specify what we mean by a single particle state, by a multi-particle state. And in particular, what we'll see is that in certain time-dependent space-times, different observers will have different interpretations, different natural interpretations of what they think a particle should be, and they will disagree with each other. And so one observer, depending on how he chooses to specify his quantum state, may think he's in the vacuum, but another observer will see the same state is actually filled with particles. And so this basically this map from here to here becomes a little bit unambiguous in curved space-time, or specifically time-dependent space-times. So what we're going to do is sort of see get a little sense of why that's true in practice. So let's start with the simplest example of a time-dependent space-time. And one, of course, that's going to be particularly relevant to the cosmology, which is FRW space-time, where the metric, and my conventions, I'm going to use the minus plus 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 convention. And so where the metric in general takes some form like this, where, of course, by dx squared, just mean dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. Now, this is standard FRW space-time. We can also write it in conformal coordinates. This is in sort of cosmic time or proper time coordinates. We can also write it in conformal time coordinates, where what we do there is we change variables, dt, to a, d eta, and I'm going to use eta to specify conformal time. And in so doing, then the metric can be written in the form a squared of eta minus d eta squared plus dx squared. Okay. Now this going to conformal time is often a very useful trick. Because it's you take out the overall factor of the expansion, and you can just think, what you can end up doing is effectively thinking of the system as living on Minkowski space with some time-dependent coefficients, and that's what we'll see actually plays out. So let's take an example of a quantum field that we're going to try to quantize on FRW space-time, and we'll see how it goes. Okay, so I'm going to start with a massive scalar field, although we'll see that the massless case arises smoothly in the limit m goes to 0, so we're really covering the massive and massless case together. And I'm going to start with the action for a massive scalar field on FRW spacetime. So what is the action? So in my conventions, the minus plus plus plus, the action for a massive scalar field is root minus g d4x minus a half g d mu phi minus a half m squared phi squared. And of course, we're using also that h bar is equal to c is equal to 1. Now here, of course, we've just got the inverse metric because we need to contract these two vectors together and the determinant and so on. So let's look at what that is, and I'm going to do it in the conformal time because that'll turn out to be most useful. Let's work out what that is. So if we know the metric, the downstairs metric is of the form a squared minus 1, 1, 1, 1, first of all, because we've taken out the overall conformal factor, it's easy to calculate the determinant of that. or specifically the square root of the determinant of that, we're just multiplying a squared, a squared, a squared, a squared together, and then square rooting. And so we get a to the 4. The inverse of that metric is also trivial to work out, because without that, it's just the inverse of the Minkowski metric, which is the Minkowski metric, and all we're going to do is invert by 1 over a squared. So we can plug that into this formula. We now know the inverse metric, and we know root minus g, and see what we get. So we get the integral d eta d3x multiplied by a to the 4 times 1 half 1 over 2 a squared d eta phi squared minus 1 over 2 a squared grad phi squared, where this is just the spatial derivative part, and then minus 1 half m squared phi squared. Nothing really happens there. So we can simplify that a little bit. The 1 over a squared cancels, in these terms, cancels the a to the 4, or it doesn't cancel it, but it brings it down to an overall a squared. So we have a piece that goes like a squared over 2 multiplied by d eta phi squared minus grad phi squared, and then minus 1 half m squared, a to the 4, phi squared. Now, the presence of this a term here means that what we would call the momentum conjugate, the canonical conjugate to phi, the guy that we're going to impose the commutation relations on, that phi with pi is IH bar times a three-dimensional delta function. In these coordinates, that quantity, it has the standard definition of the variation of the Lagrangian with respect to the velocity of the field. And in these coordinates, just doing that differential, we get the normal thing, d eta phi, but we also have the a squared comes in there. So, because of that, already we see that when we quantize the system, so we're going to want to impose that phi are canonical commutation relations at x time eta with phi at x prime at the same time is 0. That's one of the guys. We also impose that pi x at time eta with pi x prime time eta is 0. Those are normal. The momenta commutes, position commutes with each other. And where all the interesting stuff happens is the fact that the fields don't commute with, and I've set h bar to 1, but let me put it there for reasons we'll see in a second. And this quantity here, I really just mean the normal product of delta functions in the different directions. So even though our space-time is time-dependent, the way we quantize is exactly as in Minkowski space. The only non-trivial thing is to correctly identify what we really mean by the momenta. The momenta is no longer the velocity exactly, because we have this extra factor of a squared. Yeah. What do you mean by well thought out?
Well, I mean, in the flat space, there's an analogy that
But it's exactly the same motivation. There's absolutely nothing different, right? Because just imagine you took an infinite number of harmonic oscillators, but where you allow the frequency in the potential to be a function of time. Right? That's basically what the system is describing. But there's absolutely no ambiguity in how to quantize that system. And that's basically what we're doing here. And in fact, you'll see that basically because... So already you might have thought, if you think for a second, well, why did we use the definition of pi where we vary with respect to the eta time? Isn't that going to be different had we chosen the original proper time, dt? Will we get something different? And the upshot is that, in fact, these relations will always be invariant under those different field redefinitions, because we're quantizing the natural phase space element, and the phase space element is invariant under field redefinitions. So yes, I would say that, in fact, we can. This really is just analogous to an infinite number of harmonic oscillators with time-dependent masses and time-dependent frequencies in general. So that is the correct description. Now, if we plug in what we actually mean, then, in terms of the field and the velocity, we have an a squared eta here. Is IH bar delta 3 x minus x prime. Now, the point is, of course, I can actually take this a squared that sat here and stick it on the other side. But in doing so, we now see that we've got a picture where the field and the velocities, they don't commute in the normal sense, but the amount by which they don't commute depends on time. Furthermore, we can also interpret in some sense that this changing value of the scale factor is effectively changing the strength of Planck's constant, because making A smaller here is a little bit like making H bigger. Making A bigger is a little bit like making H bar smaller. So this is always true when you have a coefficient in front of the kinetic term. If that coefficient changes, the physics is very much as if you'd effectively change the value of Planck's constant. And so you can make the quantum corrections, the strength of quantum corrections can effectively be smaller and larger depending on the overall value of the scale factor. However, what we're actually going to do is undo that somewhat by doing a rather standard trick of canonically normalizing the field. And the trick is basically to say, well, you've got this a squared sat here. It'd be actually much easier to think about the physics if effective value of Planck's constant wasn't changing with time and we had some sort of fixed value effective value of Planck's constant. But it's very easy to do that by redefining the field to absorb this a squared sitting out here by just simply saying, let me define, because I can, phi is u over a. And it's clear just by sight that if we do that, we're going to cancel out the overall a squared dependence in front of the kinetic term. Now, an important point is you might worry, well, if we do that and then we try to quantize, do we get the same thing as we got before? And the answer is yes. The quantization procedure is invariant under field redefinitions. This is an incredibly useful fact in life. It's not just true for linear field redefinitions, it's true for nonlinear field redefinitions. We can basically take whatever system we write down, change variables of the fields or whatever completely at will, and quantize it, and it doesn't matter which variables we choose to quantize it. We'll get the same answer. This is a fact that will become very useful when we get into the interacting theory. We'll find we'll do a lot of field redefinitions to make things as simple as possible. Yeah?
U is still
a
function of
error. Pardon?
U is still a function of error.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So U is our field. So in putting nothing depend, I meant it really depended on everything. Whereas this guy just depends on eta. So in fact, always when you're thinking about a system, the best thing to do is always to change variables as much as possible to write the action in its simplest possible way before you then go through the procedure of actually quantizing. And that's effectively what we're going to do right now. So let's plug that in the action and see what we get. And the only complication really comes from this term, where we have derivatives of phi. Of course, we'll get two pieces. We'll have a derivative of u over a, and then minus a prime over a squared u, which we can write like so. In all the other terms, though, of course, because a is only a function of eta, there is no problem finding out how things convert. So let's take that formula and plug into the action and do the change of variables. So we have our action for our scalar field in conformal time is going to be, so there's an overall a squared here, which is going to cancel the 1 over a squared we've got from doing this redefinition. Let me write it out explicitly. That cancels that, times d eta u minus a prime over a u squared overall 1/2 minus 1/2. Similarly, the a squared out front cancels the 1 over a squared inside. We have grad phi squared, and then minus 1/2 m squared a to the 4 phi squared. Sorry, that's supposed to be u. So in doing that, of course, we had a to the 4, and then we had u squared over a squared, and the a squared cancels the 4 and makes it a 2 there. Okay, so let me rewrite that out again so we see it a little more elegantly. So the only complicated piece now in this whole thing is this square here. Let's square it out and see what we can do with it. So we get 1/2 d eta u squared. When we square out this thing here, we get a d eta u times u a prime over a. And then we have plus 1/2 a prime over a squared u squared minus 1/2 grad u squared minus 1/2 m squared a squared u squared. Now, this piece here looks a little bit annoying because it's a single-order derivative term. It's not really clear how you can view this as a kinetic term. But it's very easy to see that this guy can be simplified because we can just write minus d eta u as minus 1/2 d eta of u squared. Then once we've done that, we can then integrate by parts and take the derivative that sat on the u squared here and shift it over onto the a prime over a, making it that in the end the u squared doesn't have any derivatives on it, and so that this effectively looks like a mass term rather than a kinetic term. So rather than going down there, let me do that over here. Let me do that steps closely so we don't get the factors wrong. So we have 1/2 d eta u squared. We have, now rewriting that term, it's minus 1/2 d eta u squared multiplied by a prime over a plus 1/2 a prime over a squared u squared minus a half, the gradient term, and then minus a half m squared a squared u squared. And so this piece we integrate by parts, and we rewrite it as plus 1 half u squared a prime over a prime. So this piece now effectively becomes like a mass term. There's no derivatives acting on the field u. It's a term comparable to this term and comparable to this term. In fact, you'll see clearly that all three of these terms are now time dependent because they depend explicitly on the scale factor. And so what you can do is simply write this equation as 1 half the eta u squared minus a half rad u squared minus a half m squared effective, which is a function of eta u squared, where m squared effective is, so we have three terms. We've got m squared a squared from here, so already the original mass, because of the change of because of the expansion history, the effective change of length scale in these coordinates, the effective mass already is time dependent just from that piece. And then we have this piece here, which adds a minus a prime over a squared. And then we have the piece that comes from here, which adds a minus a prime over a prime. But then you'll notice that when you work this guy out, a prime over a prime is a prime prime over a minus a prime over a squared. So that this piece and this piece combine simply to give m squared minus a double prime over a. And that's it. So what we reduce the system of a massive scalar field on FRW space-time to effectively the system of a scalar field on Minkowski space with a time-dependent mass, with a time-dependent mass term. And that's really, at this level, that's the only effect of the expansion history, is to make the mass effectively time-dependent. And this is now sort of, this makes it clear, this analogy, that when you think of a quantum field really as an infinite sum of harmonic oscillators, indeed it is, and in this language, the only thing we've done is effectively change the mass term here and make that time-dependent, equivalent to changing the different frequencies in the harmonic oscillator and making those time dependent. So I've changed variables to a different field u rather than the original field phi. Nevertheless, I can canonically quantize just as before. And because the physics doesn't actually depend on the field variables we use, the whole quantization procedure is invariant under the field redefinitions, we could just immediately write down that u x at time eta has to commute with u x prime at time eta. On top of that, we need to specify what do we mean by the momentum conjugate to the field u. So I'm going to use a different variable now than the pi I had before. Let me call it P, so it's even more familiar, is dl d eta u. Well, of course, now, because we've got rid of the a squared in front of here, this is just the normal thing. It's the velocity. The momentum is just the velocity of the field. So this P is the quantity that itself should also commute at equal times, and it's that P that when you look at the commutation of the relation of the field and that P, that now gives I H bar, and I'll set H bar back to 1, delta 3 X minus X prime. And this, of course, is equivalent to the statement that ux eta commutes with d eta u x prime eta. And so it looks like a standard quantization relation, which makes sense because we've rewritten it as an ordinary scalar field on Minkowski space with nothing but a time-dependent mass term. So now, let's follow our procedure that we do in Minkowski space for quantizing the thing. It looks more or less the same, so we might imagine that something very similar works. In particular, what we want to do is define something like creation annihilation operators for this system and follow more or less the same procedure so that we can determine what we mean by particles. But of course, as I've already hinted at, what we'll see is that's going to become somewhat ambiguous. There's no longer going to be a unique set of creation annihilation operators. We'll be able to define such things, but what we'll find is there isn't really a unique thing representing the fact that in curved spacetimes there isn't a unique definition of particles. And the way you see this, let's follow our prescription. So of course, these guys are all really operators. So they all, I'll stick a hat on everything to signify that they're operators. And we want to follow a procedure analogous to what we do in Minkowski spacetime. So we expand our operator quantity in terms of so because our metric, of course, is still translation invariant, we still have translation invariants, x goes to x plus a, the metric is invariant under that. It's still natural to decompose all modes into Fourier modes. There's no problem with that because we don't have any non-trivial space dependence. Everything here is in the non-trivial time dependence. So when we do that, we can go into momentum space in the three directions and define some quantity ak and some quantity ak dagger, which at the moment are just being defined by this formula, effectively. And this guy here, whatever it is, it must be multiplied by some function of time times e to the I k dot x. And this guy, whatever it is, it must just be the Hermitian conjugate of that term because the field is supposed to be real. So whatever we put here, we have to put the complex conjugate here. To see that it is indeed real. So far, this relationship just defines these operators. And if we're working in the Heisenberg representation, which is what we're effectively going to do now, then we demand that the quantum field satisfies the operator version of the classical equations of motion. In particular, then, of course, in the Heisenberg representation, the operators are explicitly time-dependent, as we've got here. And on top of that, this operator should satisfy the same equation of motion as the classical equation of motion. Now, in a nonlinear theory, that becomes slightly ambiguous because of operator ordering, you know, what order you take the operators in. But at the moment here, we're just doing a nice, simple free theory, and there's absolutely no ambiguity in this step. So what is our equation of motion? Well, our action that we've got to is of the form 1/2 d eta phi squared minus 1/2 rad phi squared minus u. Time-dependent mass, which is m squared a squared minus a double prime over A. So the equation of motion that follows from this is simply U prime prime minus del squared U is equal to minus M squared effective as a function of time multiplied by U. Now, when we write the field like this, we're essentially going into Fourier space. And so the only way this overall field can satisfy that equation of motion is if each of these terms individually satisfy the equation of motion. This one is just the complex conjugate of that. So if that one satisfies the equation of motion, this one does, obviously, because it's the complex conjugate. So what we effectively need to do then is take this thing, stick it in there. Well, all we're doing is really going from position space to a momentum space. And so the trick is simple to say that an individual mode, UK, has to satisfy, this is the three momenta squared, this relationship here, U. Or we could rewrite that as UK prime prime is minus K squared plus M squared effective eta U. So this equation now, K squared plus M squared, that looks like the energy squared that we would normally get, except now, of course, that energy, whatever it is also explicitly time dependent. Nevertheless, it's useful to introduce the notation that this is omega squared K, which is a function of eta multiplied by U. Yep?
So we're guaranteed that the DNA that you're satisfied with creation and maturation?
Not yet, no. We're not guaranteed of anything yet. Because we're only guaranteed, yeah. So what we're only guaranteed when we've determined how these guys are going to be normalized. And we haven't yet specified how those guys are going to be normalized. So we have an equation that looks more or less familiar. It's an equation for the UKs. Yeah, sorry, that's okay. Second line, there's a K there, yeah. So we have an equation that looks more or less familiar, but now the angular frequency depends on time. So I can't simply write down that the solution of this is plus or minus I omega K eta. This is obviously the wrong solution, because if I plug that in, that would only work if omega was a constant, which it certainly isn't in the present case. Now, this is really where everything comes from now, because what we did before in the Minkowski case is to identify this quantity here as the annihilation operator. We wanted to say that that quantity annihilates a positive energy particle state. And this quantity creates a positive energy particle state. And the way to achieve that was to identify this guy here as a positive energy mode, meaning that it goes like e to the minus omega k eta in this language. And then similarly, this guy being the complex conjugate is the negative energy mode, meaning that goes like e to the plus I omega k eta. And that tying together this guy as the annihilation operator with that positive frequency mode here is the thing that ensures that we only create, when we do our algebra and we look at interactions, we only create positive energy particles. We never create a negative energy particle. The problem is now this equation is time dependent. And if this equation is very strongly time dependent, then there may not be a solution that even looks anything close to this relationship whatsoever. So there's now no longer a unique way to split UK up into positive and negative energy solutions. You don't know how to do it. There's no longer a unique way. And that's really the key that says, if we don't know how to split, if we don't know which of these, obviously this is a second order differential equation, it has two solutions. But if we don't know which of those two solutions, or which combination of those two solutions corresponds to positive energy particles, how do we know which one of the solutions to choose to put here? Because if we did find two solutions, let me call them VK1 and VK2, we could always take some arbitrary superposition of those two guys, and that would still allow that this quantity here satisfies the equation of motion. Furthermore, it'll still also satisfy, with some conditions on these guys, the canonical commutation relations. So we don't know how to do that uniquely. However, there is a regime in which we do know. And that is the so-called WKB, or adiabatic regime, which is really just this is just the WKB approximation that you learn about in basic quantum mechanics. And this regime is such that this guy is time dependent. And the key point is how strongly time dependent is it. If it's only very slowly time dependent, if it varies only very slowly, what do we mean by slow? Well, we basically mean that omega k, the derivative of that, is small. This is what we mean by adiabatic. But we can't, to say something is small, we've got to say what is it small relative to. Now, if you think omega has dimensions of inverse time, omega dot has dimensions of inverse time squared. So what quantity can we construct in that equation for which omega prime will be small to? Well, the only quantity is omega k squared itself. What this is saying is if the variation of the frequency, the angular frequency with time, is that time scale of that is much longer than the time scale associated with the oscillations. So let's suppose we can think of omega k varying with time in some sense like that. If we're actually looking at modes which oscillate very rapidly, so that the 1 over omega is obviously the time scale of oscillations, so here we have some sort of characteristic time scale of the overall variation of omega. But if the 1 over omega k time scale of the oscillations is much shorter, so that it's oscillating many, many, many times in the time for the frequency to change, then you're in an adiabatic regime. And the frequency is changing sufficiently slowly that it becomes, again, more or less unambiguous how to specify what you mean by positive energy modes and negative energy modes. But this regime of validity is the one that is taken into account by the WKB approximation. On the other hand, if you've got the opposite situation, where you're looking at frequencies which are such that the time scale of oscillation is itself longer than the time scale with which the frequency changes, then in that regime, you have absolutely no idea how to split into positive and negative energy modes. And that what the physics of that is it gives rise to particle creation. Because effectively, the same thing is saying, if I don't know what a particle is, it also means I'm not really forbidden from creating particles from nothing. And so one of the key predictions of quantum field theory in curved spacetimes is it suddenly becomes possible to create particles out of the vacuum. And effectively, this is another way of saying this, of course, is because the spacetime is time-dependent, you don't have a conserved energy. Because you know that you only have a conserved energy when you have a time-like killing vector. So Noether's theorem tells us that conserved energy arises as the conservation law associated with time translation invariance. So in space-time, what this means is there must exist, for a conserved energy, there must exist a globally defined time-like killing vector. So a killing vector, if you remember from GR, is a solution of the killing equation. And killing vectors represent the symmetries of a space-time. The maximum number of killing vectors you can have in four dimensions is 10, because that's the maximum number of symmetries you can have, because 10 is also the number of generators you have for the Poincaré group. You've got, in the Poincaré group, you have four momenta, that's three space momenta and energy. You have three boosts, and you have three rotations, making a total of 10. And so when we say that Minkowski space is a maximally symmetric space-time, we're saying that on that space-time admits the maximal number of killing vectors, which is 10. Similarly, Anti-de Sitter space has 10. De Sitter space has 10 because those are all the maximally symmetric space-times. In the present case, all we need is one killing vector which is a solution of the killing equation, which is time-like everywhere. So that means that K mu is less than zero in my convention because we're using minus plus 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 form of the metric. When that is true, Noether's theorem implies that there's a conserved energy. When you have a conserved energy, you can't create particles from the vacuum because it would violate conservation of energy. And a particle should have, in some sense, positive energy. The vacuum should sense be the minimum energy state, so you can't possibly create a particle from the vacuum. But when you don't have a conserved energy, as essentially in every FRW space-time, then there's no longer energy conservation to forbid you from creating particles from the vacuum, forbid you creating particles from nothing. And this is captured by the fact that in this equation, there's no longer a unique way to split into positive energy modes and negative energy modes. And the only case where you really can do this is when the variation of the background is so slow relative to the frequencies you're looking at all times you sort of think you're in Minkowski space with just a very slightly changing frequency. And it's this mechanism, and this is what we'll get to more in detail in the other lectures, but let me, as I'm getting close to the last minute, let me just describe you the mechanism in very, very simple terms. This is what inflation does. This is the whole mechanism by which the quantum fluctuations in the universe the quantum fluctuations in the inflaton field that seed the density fluctuations that are the small that by gravitational instability grow and eventually form galaxies. These are created in inflation precisely because of this mechanism, because what happens in inflation, the universe expands exponentially. So it's a particular example of FRW, which written in conformal time looks like this. In inflation, you have a characteristic scale of curvature, which is the horizon size. So this picture here is supposed to represent the horizon size, R, which is H minus 1, which in expanding universe it ties with the particle horizon you have in De Sitter space. But it really, in other words, it's really just the curvature length scale. So if I'm in an expanding universe, then locally nearby me, space is always effectively flat. But of course, the presence of curvature, the fact that the Ricci curvature goes like h squared, eventually I'll see that more and more as I go out to larger distances. And the horizon size is effectively the scale at which you see that curvature come in. Now, as long as you're at distances which are smaller than horizon, you think you're on flat space. And so this is precisely the region in which it becomes a good approximation to assume that the frequencies are sufficiently slowly varying that you can talk about positive and negative energy modes. But out here, well outside the horizon, this approximation is no longer true. So well outside the horizon, there's no notion of positive and negative energy modes. And so what happens in during inflation is that because of the expansion of the universe, physical modes get stretched by the expansion. And you start out, when they're well inside the horizon, you have a notion of positive and negative energy particles. You know what a positive energy particle is. But those modes physically get stretched. You go well outside the horizon. You go into a regime which you have absolutely no notion of what you mean by positive energy particles. Energy is like not conserved by order one effect. And then eventually, when inflation stops, those modes come back in again, back into the horizon. But they went through a region. You started out with a well-defined notion of energy. You go into a region where you don't have any notion, and you come back in again with a well-defined notion of energy. But the end product of that is, because there was an intermediate region where you didn't know what you meant by a particle, even if you started with the vacuum before the modes go outside the horizon, when you come back in again, you find yourself in some excited state filled with particles, filled with quantum fluctuations of particles. So the vacuum state suddenly turns out to be a state which is filled with particles. And this is the key feature of quantum field theory in time-dependent space-times. And basically the calculation of what those quantum fluctuations are is what the essence of the calculations will do in developing inflationary cosmological perturbation theory for the context of inflation. Okay, so we'll get to that in more detail in subsequent lectures.
Can you comment the time-like Killing vector?
Yeah.
In black hole space-times, that's also valid.
Right.
So the Hawking radiation...
It's not time-like everywhere.
Right.
It's asymptotically time-like, yeah.
What about the horizons in black hole
space-times? So the time-like, the guy that's time-like at infinity,
right,
that becomes null at the horizon, becomes space-like inside. It's certainly tied to that, that's right. I mean, you wouldn't have particle creation if you could define a globally time-like Killing vector. So all the non-trivial effects, such as Hawking radiation and Unruh radiation and so on, are all tied to the fact that in such space-times, although there may exist locally a time-like Killing vector, there isn't globally one. And if there's not globally one, then you don't have a fully well-defined notion of energy, and that allows for the vacuum state, effectively, to be a state filled with particles. Yeah.
So what we're doing today, is it specific to a RW, or can we do it with any metric?
So what we'll do, we'll go through how to do it for any metric. It's not specific to FRW at all. It's really this works for basically any time-dependent space-time. Whenever this condition is violated, you will have the same situation where you'll have particle creation because you no longer have a unique definition of positive and negative energy modes.
Can we always set the curvature effect to an effective mass field?
You can't always write it in this form, no. No. The fact that we've already gone into Fourier space, we could only do because we have space-like translation symmetry. Now, if your space-time was a complicated function of time and space, then we couldn't reduce it to such a simple equation. We'd have to deal with it either in real space or use not Fourier modes, some other decomposition depending on the amount of symmetry. If you don't have any symmetry whatsoever in your problem, then it's just a horrendous equation. So this guy is super simple because it looks more or less like what you want it to look like, except now you just have some extra time dependence. Yeah.
Quantum space time for accelerated
quantum. Yeah. I will get the same effect. That's right. Yeah. That's right. And that's the same thing. That's because we'll get to that a little bit later. The vacuum state of Minkowski to an accelerated observer, the way he specifies what he means by positive and negative energy frequencies is the way it is different than the way a guy who is not accelerated specifies positive and negative energies. And therefore, he will interpret the real vacuum state, which is the state of the non-accelerated observer, as a state filled with particles relative to his definition of particles. And that's a very closely related thing. But the more general situation, that's still like a situation where both that and the Hawking radiation is more a situation where at all times the two observers will disagree on the notion of particles. Here in the cosmological context, though, we're more interested in a slightly different question where you start out with nothing. You are in vacuum to start out with. But then, because of the time dependence, you actually generate particles through the expansion of the universe. And it's those particles, those quantum fluctuations that you generate, that are the quantum fluctuations that basically set up the initial conditions for the entire of the rest of cosmology. And so that's why this quantum calculation we're doing right now is the calculation, the most important calculation in cosmology in some sense, because it's the one by which we can determine those primordial fluctuations. And those are the things that map into the fluctuations you see in the CMB or large-scale structure and so on. And of course, one of the amazing things in cosmology is that we really believe that our universe as we see it now, this largely classical universe, originates from quantum fluctuations. Why does it originate from quantum fluctuations? Where do those come from, even though you start out in vacuum? And it's all to do with this effect that there isn't a well-defined notion of particles in a time-dependent space-time.